This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Because we will talk pretty much about the King James Bible. There's plenty to say about the good old King James Bible. You know it oh so well. But to remind you now about the Bible, this Bible we read, it's been translated into many, many, many languages. It was meant to be translated into many, many. And it's intended to be translated into even more. As many as there be, we get to work on it to translate it. And here we are with, you know, English being a language so many people speak that there has been a lot of English translating that has happened. It started, we talked about those guys that started doing it back then, and they did a lot of them. And then I told you that there's this second period, which is the 20th century. So you have this sort of roughly the 16th century with a period of lots of English translations of the Bible, but most of which you don't know. I list them up there and you probably say, I don't know those. I don't own those. Of course, nowadays there are apps and you can actually read them if you want, which is one of the cool things about phones and apps and everything, because, you know, there was a time before this, all this, the internet and everything else, when you could talk about, hey, there was a Coverdale Bible that was from Tyndale's Bible, the Matthew's Bible, and they had the Great Bible. No, they did the Geneva Bible. And those would just be historical things that, I don't know, maybe you'd see them someday if you found one or ordered it. I don't know what. But now you just want to see how it reads or what it looks like, how it did a certain verse. Why, that's just a few clickety clicks or tappity taps away nowadays, which is nice. But they don't sell a lot of these, you know. They're not marketing these much. They're old, very old English. And now the 20th century came along, and there was another big surge of lots of translations. And the results of that activity, we do carry some of those Bibles. And I keep saying we're going to get to that, and I just think maybe someday we will. However, there is a Bible not on this screen. Not on the screen, but here, I want to show you something amazing, though, first. You know, you notice this whole copy of the Bible here, that somebody took a picture from a bookstore or something, and notice it has the sticker. It says, signed copy. You see that sticker? Signed copy. And in the little caption, they said, yeah, I'm skeptical. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't that be... Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, who's slapping signed copy stickers on books in that bookstore? Just it's kind of silly, right? I don't mind. I'm not ashamed to get a few laughs, but I do want to talk about that conspicuously absent Bible on that slide that we looked at, where you saw all those Bibles there, and then we say, well, look, there are those ones from back then, and then there are those modern ones, but there's this one that seems to be missing, and it's a pretty significant Bible in English. I would say it's pretty significant. Yeah, all the statistics would say it's significant. And all of you know that there was never a more significant English Bible than that one we call the King James, that they called the Authorized Version. That was its name when they did it. They called it the Authorized Version. And then it also came to have King James name to it. So they would sometimes call it the King James Bible. You also see references to it in writings by British people sometimes as just the King's Bible. And now we just usually call it the KJV, the King James Version. There have been few editions of the Bible in any language as influential as the King James Version of the Bible. In English, obviously. So it's worth talking about, and it's just a fascinating thing. And also, there are so many misconceptions and attitudes that I find a little bit odd toward the King James Bible, positive and negative. And so, let's discuss a little bit about the King James Bible. I have another nice picture for you. These are just compliments of the internet. Show me that next photograph that the internet provides for us all. This is from one of the front pieces, copies. To the Most High and Mighty Prince James, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. It's got all that formal language. It was a very formalized, official Bible. So it's grandiose, you know, with all of those things. That is the original. I don't know how many copies today include all this stuff or not. The preface, the stuff from the translators, I do not know. I don't buy a lot of them to inspect them all. But it's a good story to know, and especially in light of what we already talked about what Tyndale did and how at the point which he died, remember, he is reported to have said with his dying words on the scaffold, "Lord, open the eyes of the King of England." And some people will say, with good reason, that that prayer was in the process of being answered, to an extent. I don't know that old Henry's eyes were ever fully opened, but at least when it came to translations and the Bible, they were, one way or another, because at near the time when this was happening, when Tyndale was meeting his unfortunate doom at the hands of those authorities over in the Netherlands, well, back in his home England, his Bible had really been popular, had been smuggled in there and had been translated. And at that time, the king had broken away from the church, from the Roman church, you know, and formed the Church of England and decided that it'd be great to have an English Bible. And so the king was behind the idea of the Great Bible, that one that was named because it was so big, because it was for the pulpits and it was for the churches, and they chained it there because it was decorative and expensive and you could read from it and all that. But that Great Bible was largely the work of Coverdale, which was pretty much Tyndale. Isn't that ironic? As he's being put to death, almost in this similar time period, the wheels are already turning for his work to be printed in a different Bible that would now be in every church. So, as we were talking earlier in the staff meeting, sometimes we don't always see the benefit of the work we do in this life. Tyndale, after he's gone from this earth, the influence and the echoes of his influence and what he did reverberated up to now. I mean, he couldn't have imagined, I think, the influence that he would have with his words. And we'll see through this Bible today that we're talking about just how influential he was. But those Bibles then suddenly, hey, it's great, they can be translated. But we got to get around to this Bible we haven't talked about. So let me show you just a couple of dates here. You can't see the beginning now, but it's 1603 is that first number. 1603. James the First becomes the king. You know this whole history with this whole soap opera we mentioned. So Henry the Eighth, you know, all that nonsense with him and those women that were his temporary wives. Henry was not a polygamist, at least not all at the same time. He was a serial monogamist. So he just cycled them through there. But oddly, there was still a childbearing problem here. I mean, a few were born, but then some didn't live. And there was so you would think that many wives he ended up with, he'd have some good possibilities with heirs. But he still didn't. The one male was a boy who became a young man just long enough to be crowned, and then he was sick, he was gone. And then they didn't want the next one in line, which would be Mary. They didn't want her because of who she was and her allegiances and being Catholic and half Spanish. And they didn't want that because they had broken away from the Roman Catholic Church. So they tried to concoct a scheme to shoehorn in someone else. So they found another different relative or semi-relative. I can't remember how she was, but this poor, unfortunate Lady Jane Grey, the 9-day queen. That didn't end too well for her. Thanks for nothing, guys. It's good to be queen. Actually, it's not. You get to rule for a week, and then it's off to execution for you. No, it did not. It didn't. So in the end, Mary becomes queen anyway. That doesn't go too well because it's pretty gory and it's tumultuous and all. But then comes Elizabeth. You know how this goes. But Mary has no child. Elizabeth has no child. The Virgin Queen. When she's gone, we are just fresh out of Tudors now. So that's where our man James comes in. Because it's a big family tree, and it's like he's the grand nephew of Henry VIII. And over in Scotland, he's the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. It's a whole thing, all right? But basically, he's James the sixth, is it, of Scotland. And he's the guy. He will now become the first, James the first, of England. And he, and that sort of begins to sort of a new family. The Stuart line, okay, begins with him. So here's a new king, all right? A new king. And this king's an interesting guy because, you know, he's from Scotland, where there had been some Presbyterianism. He's, some people say he's very sympathetic to Protestantism. Some people say he's sympathetic to Puritanism. Because you see, in England now, you've got the Church of England, but, and you still have some Roman Catholics, and you have the Church of England, but then you also have some Puritans. Who are those guys? They think the Church of England needs to be purified. They think the Church of England needs to be reformed. You know, is there ever a time when the church doesn't need to be reformed? I mean, let's just be honest. It's just by degree difference. But the old Latin phrase they used was semper reformanda, always reforming. You're never finished, really. The church can always use reforming, and especially if it's big and powerful in many ways. And so the Church of England was large and powerful, like the church in Rome in some ways. So the Puritans said, let's get back to more biblical principles. And, you know, as you sit here today in a church that has Methodists on the sign, why, the founder himself, essentially, an Anglican, saying to the church, we need change. We need to reform. We need to get back to biblical principles. This is nothing new. So it was happening almost every century we see it. So the Puritans have their concerns. And so James is sort of caught between them. The Church of England authorities want some things. They want to know that he's going to do things like they want. And the Puritans want to think that he's going to do some things like they want. So they call the Hampton Court Conference in 1604 to try to address these issues. And not on the agenda was the Bible translation. That wasn't one of the things they were going to address at all. But they were addressing some other things. I have here now a book I'll read a few lines to you from. This is a book by a gentleman named Alistair McGrath of Oxford University. And Alistair McGrath is a fantastic writer of like 6,000 books, give or take. He's written a lot of books, and they're all pretty good books. I don't know how he does it, but he writes a lot of books. And he's solid. And this is a book called In the Beginning, The Story of the King James Bible and How It Changed a Nation, a Language, and a Culture. Interesting story about the King James Bible. And one of the things in here, he's talking about that part, by the way, where it says how it changed a language. I mentioned to you before the timing of this. I'll let him speak here where he says, the story of the King James Bible cannot be told without an understanding of the remarkable rise of confidence in the English language in the late 16th century. What was once scorned as the barbarous language of plowmen became esteemed as the language of patriots and poets, a language fit for heroes on the one hand and for the riches of the Bible on the other. So the English language was kind of coming into its own at this time, but there are issues on the table with this Hampton Court Conference, and I marked this one to let you know. Here's what the Puritans were saying. The Puritans, their representative John Reynolds, set out four Puritan demands as followed. One, that the doctrine of the church might be preserved in purity according to God's word. Two, that good pastors might be planted in all churches to preach the same. Three, that the church government might be sincerely administered according to God's word. And four, that the Book of Common Prayer might be fitted to more increase of piety. So, these are nothing in there about Bible translation. But they start to go at it about these things. And it's tough on poor Henry. James is realizing, man, being a king, a little more of a headache than I might have thought it would be. He's in the middle of this conference, and he's kind of trying to mediate here. But then along comes this suggestion about a translation, which is seen as an opportunity. So it says here, the breakthrough came when John Reynolds, the leader of the small Puritan delegation, proposed a new Bible translation. It is not clear where the proposal came from, nor what his underlying motives might have been. In his account of the meeting, Toby Matthew, Bishop of Durham, noted a Puritan demand that only one translation of the Bible was to be declared authentic and read in the church. Was this a negotiating strategy to secure approval for the Geneva Bible? See, the Geneva Bible was the Bible the Puritans liked, the one that had been done in Geneva during Mary's reign when all the Protestants had to leave, or a bunch of them had to leave, and they did a Bible in Geneva. But Geneva was the haven of the Calvinists, and so it had a lot of notes in it, marginal notes and comments, and those comments leaned heavily in a Protestant and Reformed way, which the Church of England did not like. So they had the great Bible in the church, chained to the pulpit, but the handy little Bible that everyone could afford, the little personal copies, were mostly Geneva Bibles. It was very popular. So the Puritans liked it. King James did not like it, and nor did the Church of England guys. But the thing is, it presented an opportunity. And so they said, well, look, maybe this can be, the king figured, maybe this can be a way to give some people what they want, and it's not that controversial. Also, the Catholics were working on their Douay Rheims translation, which was from the Latin, and they didn't want a Roman Catholic translation to take over for sure. So McGrath says, there is no record of any final royal authorization of the completed translation. However, it is important to note, well, there was a fire that destroyed some records, so he says. But he says, the decision to proceed with a new translation in English, translation of the Bible, was the most important, some would say the only, positive decision taken by the Hampton Court Conference. And it says that, trying to find where he talked about this. It is impossible to overlook another factor that was significant. To support the new translation would be to win royal favor. Basically, what he's suggesting is that this translation gave them a chance for a win. The king could say, "Ah, I'm giving you something you want." And it's not that controversial. I say all that to say, well, that's the origin. If you wondered, where did the King James Bible come from? It just came from these guys deciding to do it in this court. So that's how it came about, that they proposed it. So how did they do it? Well, let me show you how the translation worked. I'll just give you the bullet points here of how they describe it. It's an interesting process. It's not like the way that with Tyndale was one guy working alone, right? He had some help, a little bit of help. The Geneva had a few people. But this is done officially. And so you have show me the next one. And we can feast our eyes here on the breakdown of how they did this. An appointed committee of 54 scholars from Oxford and Cambridge, the experts in Hebrew, Greek, and so on and so forth. The records show that not all 54 participated. They ended up with probably 48. They didn't have money to pay them. They were the treasury, the king's, or the royal funds, the treasury was depleted. They said, look, we'll give you like other favors and everything, and you'll be doing a real good service. And, you know, so how about that? So it's kind of like, how about you do this good hard work pro bono, because the king said you should. So the Archbishop of Canterbury, Richard Bancroft, oversaw the whole thing. They had these guys working in six teams, and it took them a few years. And he lists in this book here the different teams, how they did it. Like, in other words, how they put them together. They had a First Westminster Company that was assigned to do Genesis to Second Kings, and they would meet in a certain place. And anyway, so they just broke it up into sections, and they had these teams work, and they just went through it. They had guidelines they were supposed to operate by. It's like 10 things. Like, keep these things in mind when you're doing. Here's what we're going for. Here's what you're trying to do. And it's interesting. They had the previous English translations. They knew that Tyndale's work had been popular. That what Coverdale did after him, using him, was popular. The Geneva Bible was popular. So they said, these are good English Bibles, and people like these. So let's not get too far from them. Let's not, like, make something wildly different from them. They're good. So they had them there. And so on that note, McGrath says this. He says, it is impossible to overlook the fact that the King James translators did not begin to translate with blank sheets of paper in front of them. They stood in a long line of translators and were conscious that their task would be influenced considerably, perhaps more than they cared to admit, by the English translations already in circulation. The 15 rules by which their translation would be governed specifically directed them to base themselves on earlier versions and to take into account all of them. And so the 14th rule in those lists of rules they were supposed to use, these translations, quote, these translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible, Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Geneva Bible, all of them. So take them into account. In that each successive translation drew upon those that preceded it, the earliest of the translations, that of William Tyndale, can thus be seen to have had considerable effect on the successors. So, these guys went to work, spent these years doing this, to create this translation, and that is what they did. So, let me say some things to note about this translation. So that we can see, just note these things, because there's some bad information that goes around. So one thing is that King James, the king himself, he was not really involved in the translation. I hear some people talk about the King James Bible as if this guy King James translated the Bible.
He just authorized it.
Yeah, I mean, and he didn't even come up with the idea. Okay, the Puritan guy just said, hey, I propose we could do this as part of the other things they were trying to accomplish in that conference. Let's have a new translation. And the king just seized the moment and said, yeah, okay, I'll green light that. And partly he did it because, again, he saw it as something positive. You know how sometimes politicians just want to get any kind of, just get a win? Like, in other words, they just want to do something that shows they had an agenda and they accomplished a thing. And in some ways, in trying to mediate between these parties, you know, he's trying, the king sees this as a chance to do something that he can point to and say, see, we're doing a new translation. I authorized that. That is, if nothing else came out of that conference positive, at least we agreed on this. You know, and so it wasn't that King James thought we have to have it or had some weird motive for doing it. So you got to watch out for the conspiratorial stuff about who did it and why. Another thing to notice about this, as I just read here from this book, this is a culmination of this basically century or so of translation work. Less than a century, but still. Tyndale had begun this with his brilliant work, and then it sort of just opened the floodgates of his successors and those who followed him and helped him. And this, the King James, is sort of like the crowning achievement of all of that. Using all that work before to make this sort of official royal one that will have the royal stamp on it. So it's also, I want to mention that whatever else we say about the King James Bible, it's a quality translation. I mean, there's not some basic problem with the methodology behind it. These were competent, good scholars. And they were trying to be accurate. They weren't playing games. They were seeking to be accurate. So it's a worthwhile translation, just in all of those respects that should matter. You wouldn't go wrong really with it, other than just the language has changed. But now also I say but, because the other thing about the King James is it does emphasize good sounding English. I mean, this is from an era where the English is supposed to sound good. We do not live in an era where it matters how English sounds. We just don't. We live in the era of the tweet. And the tweet is never good English. Nobody cares if it's good English. And so, when's the last tweet you read and you felt like, hey, that's a decently constructed sentence right there in that tweet? That almost doesn't happen. Because our day and age, nobody cares about whether English sounds good. And half the time, it's hard to even understand what people are saying. We just fire out choppy sentences that are vague, and we have half the time, I'm not sure the words even mean what we think they mean. And, you know, it's like, it's just the way we've come to be with the way we communicate. And there are a lot of factors behind it. But if you lived in this time period, when you have to remember, I mean, this is the Elizabethan age when all these poets had been writing, and you had Shakespeare, he'd written all these plays, and I mean, people really liked how it sounded. And I don't mean just a few highfalutin types, you know. I'm not talking about, well, yes, of course, there were these scholars and whatnots. No. I mean, like, the people on the streets enjoyed it. Who do you think went to Shakespeare's plays? Not the today, if today the audience in a Shakespeare play, you might have an idea what they would look like and who they would be. And you would say, yeah, the crowd that goes to hear a Shakespeare play today, why, that's not the crowd that goes to the Monster Truck Rally or the Thunder Game or to see the latest really stupid movie that's a comedy about a guy who became a woman and ate a chimpanzee. I don't know, whatever. But yeah, whatever it was. That's a different crowd. You're like, yeah, the Shakespeare types. But in Shakespeare's day, in this day, why, just the everyday people liked to go to those plays. They even had a certain appreciation for how well he crafted all that, how all the dialogue was so good. And, you know, it was just a different time. And particularly among these type of people who are making a Bible that everyone will read, they say to themselves, we really want this to be good. I mean, we want this English to sound great. We want it to be accurate. We don't want to mess up what God's Word says. They respect the revelation and what it means, but they do want that English to sound pretty good. So, and Tyndale was good at that, and they did the same. And to that extent, sort of my next point here plays into that, and I'll show you a little bit about this other book I have. But the last point on this slide here says that over the next two centuries, this book, this translation, the King James, would come to dominate across the English-speaking world. It became a classic, as now you would say that it is, and I mean, even the most secular person would say that it's been a highly influential book and one of the classics in English, and it's been the most widely printed, widely distributed, widely read text in the English language, this version, this King James Bible. Most of us in this room probably at one point in life read only that, heard only that preached or read from in church, you know, and perhaps you're even someone who for many years didn't know another translation existed, hardly read one, and was suspicious the first time you heard one because you thought, that don't sound right, you know, because that's how deeply ingrained that version became. It was behind everything, and so it became that. And by the way, what helped it become that? Besides its own, the masterful nature of its own English and just how well it took hold. But think about world politics and everything. Think about the timeline of the British Empire. I mean, during the late 1600s, all the 1700s, 1800s, the British Empire is expanding to a global empire. It stretches around the world. And everywhere it goes, so goes English, and so goes Christianity too. And what do you know? The Bible gets read. And what Bible might that be? Well, for a couple of hundred years, the King James was it. So the King James Bible went around the globe with English, with English people, with English dominance in government. And so it became such a widely read text that it had a major impact on the language itself. And so that's the nature of this book here that I'll mention to you. That's a great title. The main title is just Begat. That's the main title of it. Begat! The King James Bible and the English Language. This guy's whole point is to show how the King James Bible permanently influenced the way everyone spoke English for all around the world, really. Australians used the phrases. And obviously all English, Scottish, Irish, and then South Africans and people across India, you know, Canada, all North America, where English would become a widely spoken, they would start to use terms and phrases. Where did they come from? You know, I read a thing one time, and you read this more than one place, it says that Shakespeare and Tyndale probably introduced more original novel phrases and terms that people use every day. To this day, by the way, be surprised in a secular age where they don't know the Bible and they don't know Shakespeare either, they quote both of them a lot. And they don't even know it. People quote the Bible and Shakespeare, some people probably every day, much more than they ever dream they do, because of all these terms and phrases. In fact, I know that McGrath did the same thing in a later chapter talking about the influence. In fact, I'll read you a few examples. If you ever thought about this, you know, the Greek and the Hebrew have certain sayings, certain little idioms and everything that are in Greek and Hebrew that we can't know necessarily. We don't speak those languages. But sometimes translators will try to turn them into an English one, and they'll sort of take hold. Like they'll turn a little Hebrew phrase or an idiom into an English one. But then sometimes they just make their own English one that sounds similar. And so, here's what McGrath says about this. He says, many of the Semitic turns of phrase that have gained an accepted place in modern English can be traced directly to the King James Bible of the Old Testament. And so, someone did a study of this. This scholar, William Rousineau, concluded that the King James Bible is an almost literal translation of the Masoretic text, and is thus on every page replete with Hebrew idioms. And so he argues that the King James Bible had this penetrative force that could best be demonstrated by observing how its turns of phrase came to be absorbed, often unconsciously, within everyday English. Hebraic idioms that have crept into our regular English usage include the following. To lick the dust, that's from Psalm, Isaiah, and Micah. To fall flat on his face, from Numbers. A man after his own heart, you know that one, from 1 Samuel. To pour out one's heart, from Psalms and Lamentations. The land of the living, a lot of verses with that phrase. Nothing new under the sun, or something under the sun, as in Ecclesiastes has that. Sour grapes, from Ezekiel, from time to time. Pride goes before a fall, Proverbs. By the skin of my teeth, Job. To stand in awe, in several Psalms. To put words in his mouth, that's in a lot of places. To go from strength to strength, how about like a lamb to the slaughter, from Isaiah. There are some other ones that are, he says, are minor modifications from the Hebraic originals. Things like to rise and shine, as in arise, shine, from Isaiah. To see the writing on the wall. We know that from Daniel, right? How about a fly in the ointment? Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Or a drop in the bucket. A variant on Isaiah 40. And then he says there are a few from the Greek New Testament as well. Like the salt of the earth. A thorn in the flesh. To give up the ghost. The powers that be. And it came to pass. Which is used lots of times. And the scales falling from someone's eyes. People use these kind of terms all the time, don't they? I mean, you don't, and I don't mean just, yeah, people who've read the Bible. No, a lot of people use them all the time. And so this book, Beget, basically just goes through and one section of it actually just goes through several of these kind of phrases. And every chapter will tell a little bit about it if you had the time. So some of his chapter titles on this are, be fruitful and multiply, let there be light, my brother's keeper, coat of many colors, fire and brimstone, land of milk and honey, what hath been wrought, living by bread alone, how the mighty have fallen, out of the mouths of babes, some of the ones we did already, no peace for the wicked, to be horribly afraid. Each one is a little chapter where he kind of gives you, okay, here's where that came from, and here's how it came to be used. And he shows you other places in literature and songs and other stuff where people used it. So people use these phrases a lot because they just became popular. They just took hold, you know. So that's amazing. So finally, though, just a quick word here about the KJV today. The KJV today. Oh, how about that church sign? Old-fashioned King James preaching. Like, they're bragging about that, you know? Don't be going down the street to that New American Standard preaching. Don't be testing NIV positive. Yeah, I'll make that joke every week if I have to. So it's become dominant. It's a tradition in a lot of places. But there's some strange things that happen with the King James now. Man, I just spent all this time praising it, its whole history, its background. I love it. I love it. Because I just like all that cool old English sounding stuff. But now some people love it for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately. And so what happens, and we'll talk about this next time with the modern translation, but as you well know, a whole bunch of modern translations did come along. I know you know because you're carrying them, and we're reading from them. They came along, and obviously their wording is going to be different in some places. I mean, naturally. Otherwise, I mean, that's sort of the whole point. Updated English, modern English, English more the way people speak it today. So this happened, and so you know, throughout in the 20th century, here come some new translations. And for some people, because the King James was so deeply ingrained for so many years, as I said, it became dominant for a couple of hundred years. It was the Bible in the English-speaking world, in every place where English was spoken. And so people grew up not imagining English speakers and not imagining there could be any other way to say those verses. And then along come some Bibles that say it slightly different. And so for some people, they just felt wrong. And they just thought, that ain't the real Bible. That don't sound right. I don't like that. I got to admit, sometimes some of the modern translations sound goofy to me. And I'll say, there's no way I'd say that way. And some of that, sometimes when I think that, it's not because, well, they didn't do a good job rendering the Greek verb. No, sometimes it's just because I like how it sounded. I like the poetry of the other way to put it. And this sounds dumb. That's just stylistic. I mean, that's just personal choice. It's like, I just don't care for that way of putting it. It might be accurate. It might be perfectly fine. And so some people started to not like it, and there was some backlash against the idea that there were newer translations. And then along came an idea, and unfortunately this has become a really problematic issue, where some people decided to make this their cause. That the problem in the church today is these evil new translations. And a lady wrote a book in the 80s called New Age Bible Translations. And she was a real kook, I have to say. But this thing made it the rounds, and suddenly a bunch of churches latched onto it and started talking about it. New Age Bible Translations. And all she did was take places where you know, like the NIV would say it different than the King James, but then there would be like this conspiratorial idea. Like, look how it says it like this. Look how they're trying to diminish God or something. You know, like, I don't have examples here, but the King James Only movement, as it came to be known, the idea of the King James Only, started to latch onto these things to show comparisons. Like, you look it up, you'll find this. You'll see it. They'll show you, here's a verse where the King James puts it this way, and here's the verse where, here's how the NIV did it. And look how they took the word Lord out. Or look how they said it differently. And somehow it's supposed to look like somebody is trying to change the doctrine or something. It's all pretty silly. I lived in Fort Worth years ago. There was this little church on a street corner where traffic went by, and they were a King James only church. Like, that was their thing. And every year they'd have a King James only conference. And they would advertise, and they'd have these kids would. They'd put like, they'd send like high school boys out fully dressed in suits with bullhorns to yell at traffic. And they would tell them, you need to come to this conference reading, you're all reading wicked translations. Anyway, and I thought, what a shame that this church is using all of its time, energy, and resources to make this their gospel message. That, you know, this is their big cause. And of course, it's all just based on complete ignorance because they just don't know what they're talking about. And so, you know, for people raised in the church, you just beware of that. That's one odd reaction, how times have changed. There's no need to have an overtly negative reaction to the King James. There's no reason to say, well, that's old English. I hate it. No, it was good for its time, for sure. And it still has its own beauty. It's some nice Elizabethan English, and it was done by competent scholars. It's perfectly good. However, we don't run around speaking that way anymore. right? Unless you, I mean, you know, if you want to be thought of as different from other people, learn to speak in King James English and just, you know, just walk around saying that. Just, you know, tell them. Yeah. Say, well, check you next time, dude. Hey, take care of yourself, whithersoever thou goest. I mean, why not? Anyway, but nobody talks that way, so it's perfectly fine that you if you don't have much use for the King James. I mean, you know, it's fine. But we also don't need to worship it like it's the only Bible there ever was. And like that bumper sticker says, King James only. If it ain't King James, it ain't Bible. That's just silly. If it's good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me.
Maybe next time, whatever. But of course, the main thing behind these modern translations is they've unearthed a whole lot of artifacts.
And that's a whole different story, too. Right.
Yeah, that's another.
There are two, briefly though, there are two differences in some modern translations in the King James. One is just the language. One is just because they're trying to translate the language people speak. But there's a deeper one too, which is a deeper rooted difference. Not a difference I think is all that substantive, frankly, but still is. And that is, King James was completed in 1611. Guess what's happened in the many hundreds, you know, of years since 1611? People keep digging. And they keep searching and they keep finding old manuscripts. And they have found stuff older. Now, the King James writers had some good Greek and Hebrew, the best in their day. They had, because after the Renaissance and everything, they had good text to work with. But they didn't have as good a text as we now have.
And Greek has school magazines and legal language.
The Dead Sea Scrolls have turned up since then. And that's Old Testament stuff. But still, all these Greek manuscripts. Which means that now when translators sit down and they do, like, you know, whatever the latest one might be. What, I don't know what the latest one is even, like.
Just that verse that I quoted in the start. I like the King James.
Sure.
Part because it says.
Me too.
To me, has a better meaning.
Yeah, and I don't want anyone to think that, the King James translators had terrible manuscripts. They were good enough. They were good. They weren't missing any major things, and their manuscripts didn't lead them to say anything, you know, into any terrible doctrines. But let me give you just one example. I know we need to wrap this up, but just so you know, so there's a place in 1 John that is the most explicit Trinitarian reference. I mean, if you wanted good verses to back up your Trinitarian belief, they were right there, right? And it said, you know, these three testify. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And they are one. All right. One little problem. That exact part of that verse doesn't appear in any old manuscripts. But at some point it entered in, maybe to help Trinitarian doctrine. But when Erasmus did his Greek text, and he was told by the Roman Catholic Church, hey, we looked at your cool Greek text, and here in 1 John, why, that part's missing. What's up? And Erasmus, who was a great scholar, said, well, it's not in any. I have access to all these Greek manuscripts now, and it's not there. And they told him, yeah, well, that sort of needs to be there. And I don't know, somehow or another, it just turned up. I think Erasmus told him, well, you're going to have to show me a Greek text that has it. And what do you know? Somebody had one, happened to have one. Yeah, so not likely it was there. Well, the King James only people now, think what they do. They take the King James, which has that verse in it. They set that verse down. Then they say, now look all of you at what the NASB and the NIV and the says. Aha! They're trying to subvert the Trinity. See, they don't realize this, you know what I mean, what's behind this. That's not what's going on here. And plus, if you need that verse to defend Trinitarian belief, your belief, then Trinitarian belief is on some real shaky ground. If that's all you've got, if that's all it stands on, then it's pretty thin anyway. Okay, so that's just one example of how that works. But yeah, those are differences. And like I said, next time, what we'll do is We'll line up. We'll show you NASB, NIV, and all the stuff that came along right up to the Message and stuff today, and the ESV and the Holman and everything else. And there was a new King James, you might have heard, right? And say, well, why did those translation committee, who was behind all those, and how were they operating, and what was their theory? Because they don't all operate from the same theory. Some of them are going, some of them are kind of emphasizing different things when they do it. So we'll save all that because we are fresh, clean out of time with ourselves.